Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the increasingly gangster-like attitude Trump is displaying as he defies congressional subpoenas and countersues House committees investigating his financial records, Roy Cohn style. Jack Blum, a veteran Washington investigator who was a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, joins us to discuss what tools House investigators have dealing with the president who is placing himself above the law and whether the legislative branch of government, with the constitutional mandate to oversee the executive branch, can send the House sergeant-at-arms to the White House to drag a reluctant witness Trump has instructed not to cooperate out in cuffs to testify before the congressional committees. And since the Secretary of Treasury has already defied the deadline set by the House Ways and Means Committee to have the IRS hand over Trump's tax returns, we will examine Mnuchin's legal jeopardy, since the law is clear that he has to hand over any tax return the chair of the committee requests, or face a felony conviction of 5 years in jail and a fine of $10,000. With very few subpoenas being used by the House and only one hearing involving Michael Cohen with damaging testimony so far, how are the Democrats going to educate the electorate about the criminality and dereliction of the Trump administration? Then, with the president now claiming the Supreme Court will protect him from impeachment, we will assess why Trump suddenly switched from claiming he has, quote, never been happier or more content, to 72 hours later firing off angry defensive tweets whining that I did nothing wrong. Jennifer Taub, a professor at Vermont Law School, joins us for a legal analysis of the case made in the Mueller report of Trump's obstruction of justice and try to reconcile why Mueller did not find sufficient evidence to convict, but at the same time laid out an extensive case against Trump involving multiple instances of obstruction. We will discuss the ample evidence against Trump and the warning by her fellow Vermonter Bernie Sanders that focusing on impeachment throughout the campaign will drown out important issues like health care and income inequality, etc. And then finally, we'll get an analysis of what might come out of tomorrow's summit meeting in Vladivostok between North Korea's Kim Jong-un and Russia's President Putin. Ken DeClaver, a clinical psychiatrist who served as a psychiatrist with the State Department and as a director of mental health services in the Bureau of Medical Services in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss his article at the Cipher Daily Brief, What Could a Russia-North Korea Summit Mean? And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who is an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery. And currently he serves as ADA counsel and as chair of the Tax Justice Network USA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jack Blum.
Good to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Jack. And what do you make of the president's sort of gangster-like approach to defying the Congress, congressional subpoenas, and then turning around using the kind of Roy Cohn tactic of countersuing, which he's doing with Representative Cummings' committee?
He is behaving exactly as a gangster would behave. The whole idea is ignore the law, don't follow any rules, just do what you want to do, and when they begin to come after you or raise hell, the tactic is delay, stall, sue, bully, whatever you can do to turn off whoever's coming after you. And the assumption is that nobody will pursue someone who's using those tactics. Eventually they'll get tired and go away, or the clock will run. That is, it'll take just too long to haul it through the courts or to actually do anything to make it effective. And that is truly something that's a matter of tearing up the American Constitution, because every official swears to follow the law and the Constitution of the United States. The president has sworn that, and they're not doing what they've sworn to do. Now, how do we handle that? The only method of handling it, really, is either impeachment or voting the bums out of office. And right now, it seems to me that we have to have some Republicans who have the spine to stand up for the institutions, that is to say, for Congress, for the Senate, and have them willing to say, we can't tolerate this, you have to obey the law. I don't know if there will be any such Republicans. I think that the closest we've come is Mitt Romney.
But on the other side, Jack Blum, the Democrats have not been tough. They have not been aggressive. They, for example, Nancy Pelosi said, just as they were taking power back in January, that they would be immediately requesting Trump's tax returns. And then the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal, said no, they're going to wait a while, and he did. And now Trump is poking him in the face. So there's only been a few subpoenas sent to the White House, not this blizzard of subpoenas that the Republicans were talking about. It's only been the House Oversight Committee, Judiciary and Financial Services and Intelligence, and the last two subpoenas were jointly served. So the only time there's been an effective hearing by the House doing its business overseeing the executive branch has been when Michael Cohen testified. And I don't understand why they've held back so long, particularly the House Ways and Means Committee, and look where their patience and politeness got them.
What I would say is that you have to have the patience and the politeness, because you have to have public support. And if the congressional committees came off as being rude and arrogant and demanding without cause, or perceived to be demanding without cause, it would be very difficult to keep pursuing. By keeping a fairly narrow profile, that is to say, not that many subpoenas, no arrogance, being very careful and laying a foundation for everything they do, they stand a good chance of having public support, and with that, a good chance of following up and having support for a follow-up, particularly in taking it to court. But the whole way that they're handling it is predicated on dealing with normal people who play within some semblance of the rules. I've lived through and, in fact, worked with situations where subpoenas have been served on the executive branch, and invariably it's been worked out by compromise, where some stuff is produced, there's an agreement to testify, maybe it isn't the person you want, maybe it's a little less in the way of document presentation that you would want, but you've got something and you're not taking a trip to court, and the system works. These people don't play by the rules at all. And I think the tax return issue is a clear example of that. The law could not be clearer. The Secretary of Treasury, and by dint of his delegation, the head of the Internal Revenue Service, has to turn over the president's tax returns under 6103 of the Internal Revenue Code. It's plain as plain can be. And they're simply saying, hey, the law doesn't apply to us. Go away.
Right. And by the way,
pretty awful.
By the way, Jack, that law, if you don't comply, you face a 5-year jail term and a $10,000 fine. So do you think Mnuchin is facing that kind of penalty?
Well, not with this attorney general, that's pretty much for sure. But he should face that kind of penalty, because brazen disobeying of the law really does create a terrible situation for our form of government. It's very much the kind of thing that autocrats and dictators do, and it simply can't be tolerated. My hope would be that there'll be some people in the system who begin to stand up and say, hey, sorry, but we don't tolerate gangsterism as a way of running the federal government. But at the moment, that seems to be a hope.
And again, I'm speaking with Jack Blum, who's a Washington lawyer, who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and he served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery, and currently he serves as ADA counsel and as chair of the Tax Justice Network USA. But, for example, in terms of congressional inquiries, and we know that Trump is defying subpoenas and countersuing Elijah Cummings, etc. So he's really playing hardball. And I don't know how we can actually prevent former White House officials like the White House counsel, Don McGahn, from testifying. I mean, can the House Sergeant-at-Arms go over to the White House and literally drag somebody out in cuffs?
In theory, yes. And indeed, there is supposedly a jail cell somewhere in the basement of the Capitol. And in theory, the Senate or the House Sergeant-at-Arms can go arrest someone and pop them in that jail cell. Now, as far as an individual who's subpoenaed, say Don McGahn, no longer working for the government, he has a really tough choice because he has an obligation under the law to respond. Now, he may go up there and say, I can't talk because I have Fifth Amendment rights or some other reason for not talking. But he really must show up because he's under penalty of contempt. And that does carry a jail term. And if I were the lawyer advising him, I'd say at the very least, you have to make an appearance and discuss why it is you may not want to say what you say, but you've got to go there.
Well, you mentioned, and we talked earlier, Jack Blum, about the approach of the Democrats, which many see as being rather cautious, given how kind of abusive and arrogant this White House is and how much Trump is placing himself above the law. What about, for example, the Boeing 737 MAX situation? Clearly, that is a case of regulatory capture, that the Transportation Department simply did not oversee the testing of this new plane, which is not really a new plane. It's a 1967 design, and it's basically a Rube Goldberg and a complete disaster. And frankly, it's really hurting brand America because Boeing was one of the most prominent and successful American companies around the world. So I don't understand why the Secretary of Transportation hasn't been hauled before a House committee to answer why she allowed Boeing to regulate themselves.
Here's the underlying problem as I see it. The oversight capacity of the House has atrophied so badly that House and Senate, for that matter, that there aren't the people with the experience and the people who have the knowledge to really play, and it takes a long time to recruit those people and bring them up to speed. First, in how to run a hearing and do an investigation. But then second, after they know how to manage the mechanics of an investigation, they have to know the substance. And that takes weeks and even months. So what happened was the budgets for staff in both the House and Senate were cut severely when the Republicans took control. The rules were changed to make it more difficult to schedule hearings. It became more difficult to do things that would enable people who worked for the various committees to gather the information they needed. All of this has contributed to an atrophying of the capacity to do oversight. I think what's happening now is the committees are trying to rebuild, but that's a long process. People simply can't walk out the door of some other job and then go to work on the Hill. to do these investigations, there has to be some lead time. Now, there's a second problem, which is the salaries on the Hill have become so low relative to the private sector that it's very difficult to attract the kind of people you need to do this sort of work. And all of that is part and parcel of why it's taking so long for serious oversight to rev up. And I think that at least some of the committee chairs are pulling in the right direction. But this will take a considerable amount of rebuilding of capacity to do the proper job. And there's a lot of work to be done. There are dozens of problems in regulatory agencies and departments that have to be looked at, and looked at in a way that brings it to public attention. At the moment, for example, EPA isn't getting the kind of oversight that it has to have. The things it's doing are pretty terrible when you come down to it. Interior has been giving away the store on many different fronts. Having oversight of that requires grasp of the substance, understanding where the problems are, and then hauling the right people in to get them to talk about what's happening. Takes time.
Well, it also would it takes regime change, doesn't it? I mean, the Democrats definitely, if they can't do much in the intervening time before 2020, they've got to be able to put their people in and take the White House, the executive branch, don't they?
I've worked in environments where the Democrats controlled both the executive branch and the Congress, and then in an environment where the Democrats controlled the Congress but not the White House. And in all those situations, Congress, as an independent branch of government, has always taken on the administration. It hasn't particularly mattered. And I think that at times we've been reasonably effective in taking on an administration that is reluctant to cooperate or turn over information. It requires persistence. It requires a way of understanding how to get the story across if they refuse to cooperate. It requires patience. And this is all stuff you learn through experience. And as I'm saying, there aren't enough experienced people who are ready to go do the job. And we've got to get those people up and ready and into action. They can do plenty, but they have to be there and they have to know what they're doing.
But given your long experience, Jack Blum, surely this is a whole different situation now with the president.
Well,
who places himself above the law and is absolutely defying the law.
Notice that there are people all through the government, including inside the White House, who are prepared to stand up and tell the Congress, and the especially in the right circumstance, what's happening in their departments and their agencies. And most civil servants are true civil servants. They swear to uphold the law, the Constitution of the United States, and they do. So if they're pulled before Congress and they're asked questions, they'll answer the questions. And here and there, there'll be people who say, no, that's not true, but usually if you dig a little bit deeper and find people who are a little lower on the food chain, who are not political appointees, they'll talk. And then there's this issue of documents. It's been a rare situation where there isn't a file that tells a story. And when people understand, there are people on the Hill, for example, who will take those documents, keep the source confidential, and use them effectively, the flow of documents really gets to be pretty good. And that's a tremendous way of figuring out what's happening and letting the public understand what the administration is really up to. So far, we haven't seen that.
Well, we've seen, because so much hope was placed in the Mueller report, and as you recall, the Democrats kept saying, we're not going to do anything about impeachment until the report is out. And my concern now is that if they don't follow up on the report, which this Attorney General tried to spin as being completely exonerating the president when it clearly does not, and there's an awful lot in that report that should be followed up on, are you concerned that if they don't fight back, if you will, then Trump's narrative is the one that stands, that it was no big deal, that the whole thing was a waste of time, a witch hunt?
It is imperative that Democrats begin to stand up, because that report includes felonious behavior by the President of the United States, in my opinion. And he has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, low crimes and misdemeanors, but he has behaved way outside the bounds of the law. There's a reason why we refer to an administration as administration. And the reason is their job is to administer the laws of the United States. It's not to make them. It's not to make it up as you go along or invent them or simply put people in who do whatever they want. It's their job is to administer the law as written. And if they don't do that, it's imperative that Congress follow up. And the remedy is, in fact, impeachment. Now, there's a real reluctance to do that because you have to have broad political consensus that it's necessary. If you go back to Nixon and his problems, what made all the difference in the world was there were honest Republicans who came up to the White House and said, "Sorry, Mr. Nixon, you have to go because this is an intolerable situation, and we are all going to go down if you don't get out of here, and we're going to have to vote to throw you out." And that was what got him on the plane, on the helicopter, and then on the plane to leave the White House. And the way that happens is you have to educate by holding the hearings and then see whether you can't get the political support to make it happen. Now, there were Republicans back in the Nixon period who joined in the vote on the Judiciary Committee in the House, and that was pivotal to getting it moving both in the House and later getting the senators to say, "Hey, wait a minute, they've really come up with quite an indictment here. You better get ready to pack your bags." Now, those Republicans are the kind of people who put country above party, and I believe there's still quite a few of those. And they were people who, many of them, lost their jobs as a result, but they didn't particularly care because they did the right thing. What I'm waiting to see is where those Republicans who are going to do the right thing are. But I think they're going to have the shaming that comes out of a set of hearings that really puts this Mueller report in the spotlight.
Well, Jack Blum, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're quite welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Jack Blum, who's a Washington lawyer, who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery, and currently serves as the ADA Council and as chair of the Tax Justice Network USA. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a legal analysis of the case made in the Mueller report of Trump's obstruction of justice.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world, but the Murphy family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me, and I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me. I sent a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Your dad.
day will come. It's catching up on you. When your race is run.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jennifer Taub, who is a professor at the Vermont Law School, and previously she coordinated the business law program in the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and was also a Associate General Counsel for Fidelity Investments and Assistant Vice President for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. Her latest book is Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Taub.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
Well, thanks, Jennifer. And just apropos of your book on the 2008 meltdown, the criminality there on Wall Street was never really punished. Main Street got hosed and Wall Street got rewarded. And now we seem to have at the very top of our government a kind of lawless president who is placing himself above the law and defying the branch of government, the legislative branch, that has oversight over the executive branch. This feels incredibly brazen, and I'm kind of surprised that the American people aren't a little more alarmed than they appear to be.
You know, one of the, besides being a longtime ongoing con artist, one of Donald Trump's greatest successes is also creating so much chaos and confusion and spewing out lies and conspiracy theories that most people get confused as to what really is happening. So, for example, he is brazenly lying about what the Mueller report actually says in black and white. And sadly, the Attorney General of the United States, who's supposed to represent the people, is helping him confuse the public in that regard.
Well, let's talk about what's actually in the report. It's such a disconnect that Mueller wasn't able to, he wasn't both able to exonerate Trump for obstruction of justice, but also wasn't able to bring charges against him. But when you read the report, there's just instant after instant laid out very clearly of obstruction of justice. So how do you explain that disconnect?
I guess I have, there's two reasons why I think there's a disconnect. I think the first is that instead of when he first announced that he had received the Mueller report back in March. This is Attorney General Barr. Instead of simply reporting to the public what it said, as he claimed he was doing, its principal findings, he didn't do that. He overruled Mueller, especially on the obstruction points. So I think that caused confusion. And I think the other part of the confusion is that even after the report is actually out, people don't have a lot of time to read 448 pages. It seems daunting. It would be very helpful if Barr had done what the Mueller team had prepared for him, which was to release summaries. A person could very easily now, you know, open up volume one or volume two and just read the executive summary and be very well informed. But again, it's kind of daunting. And so if Barr had actually been representing the American people, he would have done that, separately released very short summaries that had been prepared so that the public could understand what the report said. And let me just say this other thing, Ian. I have spent most of my time since it was released focused on that second volume, the one to which you referred, about obstruction of justice, where Mueller lays out a very clear case. Although he doesn't come to the conclusion that the president criminally obstructed justice, he goes through 10 episodes and sets out how element by element, most, but not all of them, constituted criminal obstruction. There's enough in that report that we know that, as Mueller said, you know, if he had not been restricted by departmental policy that you cannot indict a sitting president, had it been anyone else, he would have been indicted. So I spent most of my time on that initially, but now I've gone and started to dig into volume one, which focuses on Russian interference in the election, and whether there were any ties with the Trump campaign and whether there was any coordination. And what I think the public is missing right now is how clearly Mueller states that there were multiple ties between the Trump campaign And people connected with the Russian government. Also, the first part of the report makes absolutely clear, and it builds on the indictments that are already released, that the Russian government interfered in a disinformation campaign online, as well as hacking efforts, interfered in our 2016 presidential election with the purpose of aiding Donald Trump. Plus, the report makes clear that Donald Trump's campaign welcomed this, although he could not establish that there was actually an agreement to work together. The report is absolutely clear that Trump welcomed this, and also the obstruction part of the report makes clear that he tried to cover up the investigation into this. So when I look at this as a whole, this is a very damning report for this president, that he welcomed illegal efforts by the Russian government to help him get elected, and that he worked time and time again to try to cover up any investigation into any connections or coordination between his campaign and the folks in Russia who went about this.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Taub, who's a professor at the Vermont Law School. She previously coordinated the business law program at the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and was associate general counsel for Fidelity Investments and assistant vice president for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. And her latest book is Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business. So how then, Jennifer, do you explain, again, this disconnect between what you've just said is in the report, and it's most certainly clear as day, it's in the report. It's pretty clear what Mueller found and how he feels about it, and yet Barr presented it in a completely different light to establish the public narrative. And, of course, Trump has been doing a victory lap, saying no collusion, no collusion, that he's exonerated, when that is not what the Mueller report's about. So when is Mueller going to speak up and set the record straight?
This next month. In fact, my understanding is the House Judiciary Committee is inviting several important witnesses to testify in public. It will be televised, the first of which is William Barr. And the questions you've just asked, I'm hoping some members of that committee ask him. You know, why did he take it upon himself to overrule Mueller on obstruction? And what I mean by that is Robert Mueller very clearly in the volume two that asked whether the president obstructed justice, he very clearly said he was not going to come to determination one way or another. And he made clear that if he could have, based on the evidence, he would have exonerated him, but he could not actually exonerate. He could not actually exonerate the president based on the information before him. And then he goes back through hundreds of pages, painstakingly laying out what would be a memo to assist. You know, if prosecutors were going to indict, it's so clearly any lawyer who would read it, and even a non-lawyer could see how he goes about it, methodically showing us as the public that there's a very, very strong case for obstruction of justice against the president. And what I find the most misleading about what Barr did, Barr actually said in that when he said both in writing in his four-page memo and recently in his press conference, he says that Mueller left it to him to make the determination. But that's not what Mueller did at all. In fact, the very first and second page of the part of the report focused on obstruction, Mueller says there are two paths. One path would be for Congress to do its constitutional duty and investigate whether the action described the obstruction constitutes grounds for impeachment. That's one path. And the other path is to wait until the presidential immunity ends. And he makes clear both on page one and later in a footnote toward the back of the report that presidents do not have immunity after they leave office. There's nowhere in the report, not a single word, not a footnote, nowhere where Mueller invites Barr and Rosenstein to step on his findings and clear the president. I suspected as much within hours of his four-page letter back in March, when he gave his sort of, you know, the little excerpts from the report. I suspected that Barr had done something wrong. It didn't smell right. And then when you actually look at the report, you see just really how treacherous it was that he that he did this. And that's why we are confused. I think this report was extremely damning for the president. And Barr somehow, I guess he took one for the team, but he's not on our team. He's on Team Trump. He's not on Team America.
So, Jennifer Taub, given that you just mentioned that some of this may be cleared up by congressional hearings at which Mueller will be questioned about the real intention of the report and the real findings of the report, not Barr's spin, does that explain Trump's bizarre behavior? Because about, you know, what, 3 days ago, Trump tweeted out that he's never been happier or more content. And now he's just totally changed. He's tweeting out all kinds of aggrieved, petty insults and in caps, "I did nothing wrong." He's whining and whining. So what happened from the confident man who said, "I've been exonerated," to 3 days later tweeting insane stuff, along with a bunch of crazy conspiracy theories that he's also been tweeting out as well? Do you think it's getting under his skin?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think what happened is we've read reports that he's someone who doesn't have a very long attention span and doesn't pay attention to detail. So I think all he, you know, all he wanted his attorney general to do was to say, you know, his mantra, you know, no collusion, no obstruction. And I'm sure Barr came to him and said, "Well, I got a little problem. The report says we couldn't establish a conspiracy," even though it says we didn't, you know, collusion is not a legal term. The report says we couldn't establish conspiracy, but there's this other part of the report, Mr. President, I imagine, he said, that didn't come down and didn't clear you of obstruction. And Trump said, "Well, you need to do it." That's what I kind of imagine. I don't know if these conversations happened. So as soon as Trump knew that Barr had done that, he probably thought everything was fine. But, you know, the report comes out on Thursday, and all of a sudden there starts to be, you know, cable news coverage, even though it was a holiday weekend. Both Passover began on Friday and Easter was on Sunday. Everyone began reading the report, and the cable news shows, folks were going on cable news saying what was really in the report. I think the thing that bothers him the most, it's not just that he keeps saying he did nothing wrong. I think he's terribly bothered by the revelation that many of his close staff refused to follow his orders. I think that makes him look weak. I think he doesn't like the fact that somewhere in the report he's quoted as saying, you know, basically how scared he was and how he felt his whole presidency was ruined because they were investigating the Russia connections. That makes him look really bad and really weak. He doesn't mind seeming like a tough guy who doesn't care about the law, but he doesn't want to seem, he's like, you know, he has, you know, dictator wannabe tendencies, and he doesn't like the fact that he, you know, people wouldn't follow his orders. I think that's bothering him, and that's why he doesn't want Don McGahn, the former White House lawyer, to testify, because it will make him look weak. But really, that's really what he is. So I think that's what's making him angry.
So the weak strong man is described as reeling back in his chair and basically saying, you know, when he learned that the special counsel had been appointed, and said, you know, "My presidency's finished and I am effed." It wasn't so much about his presidency, it's about him personally. I think this is a man who really is carrying a lot of guilt, isn't he? I mean, isn't that what one would imply from what he said?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a light bulb went off in my head today when I read some reporting by Maggie Haberman and some others in the New York Times. I'm not sure if you've seen this piece, but it's about Kristen Nielsen, how before she was forced to resign from her position at Homeland Security, she was trying to apparently get more attention on future, you know, interference by Russians for our election, you know, upcoming 2020 election. And according to the article, and there are many sources, not just her, because obviously she's probably trying to rehabilitate herself at the moment after overseeing locking children in cages and such. But at any rate, there are many sources claiming that Pompeo had told her, you know, don't, you know, we don't like to bring that up. Don't bring up Russian interference to the president because it upsets him. And according to the story, one of the things that upsets him the most, he's not concerned about the integrity of our elections, our democracy. He thinks any talk, according to this article, any talk of Russian interference makes it look like he did not win the presidency legitimately. And to me, that's like it's such an incredible tell on his behalf. And so I started to think, here's the light bulb. I started to think about it. And I'm thinking, you know, what the Mueller report is telling us, the Russian intelligence worked through WikiLeaks to release really damaging information about Hillary Clinton right when damaging information had come out in early October about Trump, about, you know, that grab him by the you-know-what video had come out. And all of this, you know, all of this happening right very close to the election could very well have swayed voters. What's even more important is that we know that Paul Manafort shared with Kilimnik internal polling data from the Trump campaign, including about Wisconsin. And ultimately, you know, we know Donald Trump lost the popular vote by around 3 million, but he only secured the presidency due to three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And that was about 70, and he won overall in those three states combined by around 77,000 votes. So every single thing counted. It was so, so close. So it strikes me, like you said, it's kind of this guilt. I think of it as he's kind of got a Lady Macbeth syndrome. You know how in Macbeth she keeps saying, out, damn spot, out, I say. She sees this invisible spot of blood because she feels guilty about the murder. And this is, you know, famous Shakespearean play. I think that's why he keeps saying no collusion. It's his Lady Macbeth out, damn spot, because he doesn't really feel like a legitimate president.
Well, just in closing, though, all this is leading to impeachment and talk of impeachment. And there's a major dilemma that the Democrats face, Jennifer Taub, and that is that on the one hand, if you don't go ahead and build on the evidence that Mueller has provided, tell the public about what really is in the report and get these people to testify what they really told Mueller and build a case, then you're accepting Trump's narrative and accepting defeat. But on the other hand, your fellow Vermonter, Bernie Sanders, the other day said that while he thinks that Trump should be held to account, he didn't want impeachment to dominate the 2020 election cycle and drown out all the important issues that he's trying to discuss, like health care, a livable wage, student debt, and income inequality, etc. So where do you come down on that?
Well, my observation is another progressive candidate, for example, Elizabeth Warren, can, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time. She's able to call for impeachment investigation while at the same time put forward very detailed, very interesting loan forgiveness programs and so on. So I don't think it's an either or proposition. I think what I heard Nancy Pelosi say the other day or what I've heard reported makes a lot of sense. In light of what you and I are talking about so far, the public is very confused about the facts. Whether we go down the path of articles of impeachment being voted on or not, the very first step is having hearings. We need to have hearings so the public can actually understand the facts here. And remember, there are many grounds for impeachment separate and apart from what Mueller investigated. You know, there are emolument clause violations where he's using the presidency to line his own pocket and contravention with the, you know, rules about getting foreign payments from businesses. There's what he's doing at the border. There's so much more. And my dear friends from Free Speech for People, Ron Fine, John Bonifaz, and Ben Clements wrote a book called The Constitution Demands It. And they go through the grounds for impeachment. You know, also Larry Tribe, who has been cautious about calling for impeachment, has now, in light of the Mueller report, beginning has called for it. We have a lot of Republicans who, for them, this is the last straw reading the Mueller report. So I think we're headed in that direction, but the first step has to be education.
Well, Jennifer Taub, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Taub, who's a professor at the Vermont Law School, who previously coordinated the business law program at the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and was an associate general counsel for Fidelity Investments and assistant vice president for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. And her latest book is Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of what might come out of tomorrow's summit in Vladivostok between North Korea's Kim Jong-un and Russia's President Putin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ken DeClaver, who's a former senior U.S. diplomat and regional medical officer psychiatrist who served in the United States Department of State in a variety of overseas assignments, as well as in Washington, D.C. during 2002 to 2016. And before his government service and since his retirement, he has published leadership profiles of world leaders such as Vladimir Putin, Kim Jong-un, and Xi Jinping, and others. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ken DeClaver.
Thank you very much for having me, and it's an honor and pleasure to be back with you.
Well, thank you, Ken. And, you know, much of the coverage I've been reading about the summit in Vladivostok between North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un and President Putin, Kim is actually in Vladivostok now, touring around, and he meets tomorrow with Putin. Much of the coverage I've read is that this is a sort of non-event. There's not a lot that can happen. One of the statistics is that's pretty sort of damning in a way is that Russia's trade with North Korea is minuscule. It's just $34 million last year. So what does Kim want out of it, and what does Putin want out of it?
I think that it's a great question. Let me preface my remarks by saying I disagree with that reporting, and I've seen much of it, which is that this event doesn't have a lot of firepower, and many of the reports would seem to indicate that it's much ado about nothing. I think they're wrong for a number of reasons. One, I think Russia, as I've written and will point out again in my comments, has deep and strategic equities in the Korean Peninsula and a shared history. And they were certainly present at the birth and creation of the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. And they've developed over many, many years deep diplomatic expertise in the country. So I think the timing is exquisitely good for Vladimir Putin, for President Putin, both in the sense that he wants to continuously, and he's been doing this in other domains, but reassert both his and Russia's primacy on the world stage in these type of grand strategic diplomatic gestures. But it's also good for Kim that it again, him meeting with yet another powerful world leader shows him to be a responsible, mature, and reasonable statesman. And that's a continuation of what he started about a year and a half ago when he met with President Xi Jinping of China and President Moon of South Korea, and then, of course, the historic Singapore summit with President Trump.
Well, what did you make, though, of the subsequent summit in Hanoi?
I think the substance, economically, I agree that certainly, Russia has interest in developing more trade, and there will probably be some trade agreements in terms of minerals in North Korea and things like that, and rail connections, the logging industries, which are the latter are their current industries there. But I think Russia can play a part in helping North Korea figure out how to get away from the punishing sanctions and begin the diplomatic process of achieving partial sanctions relief, particularly in the area of agriculture, where they've had devastating harvests last year with a 9% to 10% decrease, and also helping rebuild the network and infrastructure to help them with their health care, because they have a devastating and raging multi-drug resistant TB epidemic that's been going on for over two decades. So I think those are the humanitarian areas which can provide a back door to sort of begin the process of offering partial sanctions relief. Whether they can diplomatically pull that off is the $64,000 question. But I wouldn't bet against them.
Right. And I think you could add to the North Korea's wish list, if you will, that Pyongyang really wants the Russian electricity supplies, since they've had so many problems with blackouts and lack of electricity. From satellite pictures, you basically see of a nighttime, South Korea's all lit up and North Korea's a dark hole. And again, I'm speaking with Ken DeClaver, who's a former senior U.S. diplomat and regional medical officer psychiatrist who served in the United States Department of State in a variety of overseas assignments as well as in Washington, D.C., during 2002 to 2016 and before his government service. And since his retirement, he's published leadership profiles of world leaders such as Vladimir Putin, Kim Jong-un, and Xi Jinping, and others. Putin, though, is on his way, is he not, to this big conference that China's putting on about its Belt and Road.
He's President Putin is piggybacking the meeting with Kim along with the Belt Road Initiative conference in Beijing. But the importance that the Russian government has attached to this, to the meeting with Kim, is the extremely high-level, detailed preparation that has gone into this meeting, really starting with Foreign Minister Lavrov's visit to Pyongyang last year in May. But over the last few months, there's been a flurry of high-level, at the highest level, if you will, North Korean officials and Russian officials who have gone back and forth between Pyongyang and Moscow, including the former Russian ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak, who before he became an ambassador was an arms control expert, and also the involvement of senior spokespersons and planners, such as the Kremlin's, one of their top officials is former ambassador to the U.S., Yuri Ushakov. So the Russians are leveraging their knowledge not only of North Korea, but of people who have deep expertise in terms of working with Americans and living in the United States who know us well to get the best diplomatic and strategic advantage that they can in this type of a summit. So I think that planning, the deep levels of planning and involvement of top layers of people increases the chances of having not only a successful summit from the optics point of view, but also in terms of hopefully some realistic deliverables that can unlock the current logjam in terms of the diplomatic peace process in the Korean Peninsula and the stalling, frankly, of the momentum that we had seen last year, the very exciting momentum involving the summit with President Trump in Singapore, the meetings and summits with Xi Jinping and Kim, and the historic summits, the three historic summits with President Moon and Chairman Kim. So I think this summit in Vladivostok has the potential to be the key that unlocks the stalled momentum and moves not only the Korean Peninsula back on track, but by interjecting Russia, I think can hopefully move the peace process forward.
But Russia can't do much about the sanctions, certainly not without China. And so isn't really China and the United States a key to ending the sanctions? And my understanding is that, we know that the talks, the subsequent summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un in Hanoi collapsed because of Kim's demands were not met over ending the sanctions. Now, they just tested a new weapon last week, the North Koreans, but they also demanded that the United States Secretary of State Mike Pompeo be removed from future nuclear talks. What do you make of that?
I think that's more... it's very interesting what the North Koreans are doing. They're doing a mix of the old and the new. The demand of the firing a tactical missile, which you know, again during this time sends a signal, if you will, a diplomatic signal. The firing of a tactical missile and the demands regarding Secretary Pompeo, who last year they've accused of having gangster-like demands. The other target of their venom in this regard is National Security Advisor Bolton, because they see these people as having perhaps influenced President Trump to shift away from a more sequential approach, as advocated by Special Envoy Steve Biegun at his talk at Stanford in January 2019. And I think that talk was a remarkable and stirring and very moving talk in the sense because it gave a lot of people on both sides of the peninsula as well as other players hope. And I think that what the Russians may want to do and may be able to do is to sort of rekindle that hope back into the diplomatic processes and nudge the Chinese along and sort of form a united front where they would have a sanctions exemption because of the agriculture and health care. Those are the humanitarian areas where they can look for exemptions.
But in terms of the Gordian knot, the Norse nuclear weapons, most analysts don't see that as a realistic possibility, that Kim would give up the very instruments that have given him the stature that he wants to make himself a nuclear player.
And I agree with that, and I've both said that in my writings and when I've spoken about Chairman Kim, that I don't see him giving up nuclear weapons. But what I've argued and will continue to say is he's basically embodied a doctrine of nuclear opacity, similar to that done by, for example, the Israeli government or the Indian government and at times the Pakistani government, which is you have nukes, but you don't test them and you don't talk about them. And if you act as a responsible statesman, then that persona sort of comes to be the norm, the new normal. And I think that's what Kim already has achieved and continues to achieve with his diplomacy. It should be pointed out that the day after the collapse of the Hanoi summit, he met with the prime minister and president of Vietnam, a U.S. ally, in a state visit. So he's, ever since his coming out, if you will, in 2018, he certainly has acted according to form as a responsible statesman. And I think that argues the more he does that, the more people are likely, other leaders are likely to accept it. And it gives him more credibility and stature, both internationally, but also with his own people.
Well, I think on our side, President Trump needs a win, doesn't he?
Yes. The challenge for the president is that the domestic political campaign, the 2020 election, is getting closer. So that's the other question, is whether Kim will adopt a wait-and-see approach, and in the hope that if President Trump were to get reelected in 2020, then he would have more political flexibility to secure an agreement than he perhaps had in Hanoi.
Well, Candek Leva, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me. Much appreciated.
And likewise, and again, I've been speaking with Candek Leva, who's a former U.S. diplomat and senior medical officer psychiatrist who served in the United States State Department in a variety of overseas assignments, as well as in Washington, D.C. during 2002 to 2016. And before his government service and since his retirement, he's published leadership profiles of world leaders such as Vladimir Putin, Kim Jong-un, Xi Jinping, and others. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org. Where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.